Good morning. So I was moved to explore the word refuge. This is interesting to me. Usually I talk about activism in one way or another. But refuge was what came up. And so I've been studying it for a little bit. The first thing that we notice about taking refuge is it means we're refugees. This means one thing in Buddhism, and that's not the same as the refugee thing in the ordinary world, but we're seeing an awful lot of the need for refuge in the world around us. And so I just want to acknowledge that our world does not look safe. Refugees are in the news like pretty much every day, whether it's children in cages, people dying in boats that go down in the Mediterranean. And a lot more of that. And then we had that people freezing in Texas, and we've had people running from floods, trying to run from floods. That's been with us for quite a while now. Wildfires in places we don't expect them. California doesn't surprise me. Oregon does. Alaska does. Canada does. And so, even though I think in Minnesota we're in one of the safer places, we are not safe physically. And then, if that weren't enough, we have eight people shot in Atlanta with racial implications, 10 people shot in Boulder, Colorado. No stories about that yet. A new voter suppression law in Georgia, and a state rep arrested just for trying to get in to watch the signing. Some of our answers came to this land as refugees from war, violence, or hunger. And some of the people who were here already were turned into the equivalent of refugees by the European ancestors of some of us. It's not like they're safe. Buddhism does not directly help us with any of this. Buddhism doesn't say, don't help yourself. It just doesn't, it doesn't give us an escape. And then, of course, I have to remember how this Heart Sutra became famous. A monk, I think, was taught the Heart Sutra by a man that he had helped in some way. And then he walked from India to China without encountering any disasters, because he was chanting the Heart Sutra all the way along. And that's how the Heart Sutra became famous. So you will find Buddhists who say that there is something we can do in a practical and physical level. But here in Soto Zen, we mostly address taking refuge from our own minds. We have the three poisons: greed, hate, and self-delusion. As far as I can see, the most fundamental of those is self-delusion, the idea that we have a separate self, the idea that things are separate from each other, the belief that there's something permanent. And it's the belief part is the problem. Ideas are not important, but there are ideas we believe so strongly we don't even notice them. And so, for instance, if you say emptiness to the average American, they assume you're talking about nihilism. If there is something permanent, then it can be annihilated. When nothing is permanent, then nothing can ever be annihilated. Life just goes on and on. So the Buddhist teaching is the opposite of that. In the Aryaparyasana Sutta, the Buddha, titled Seeking the Supreme State of Sublime Peace, the Buddha said, "Monks, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here, someone, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. And so forth, through sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. And what is the noble search? Here, someone, being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana," and so forth. So he's talking about finding refuge in that which is not subject to arising and ceasing, which is not ourselves. It's not our lives, our family, our house, our money. It's none of those things. And then he says, "I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana." So, about 6 weeks ago, I had a personal experience of things being subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and so forth. I had some very strange physical sensations, and then I became afraid about them. And then I went to the emergency room after calling urgent care and after consulting with a few people. And it was very strange because I posted on Facebook and somebody called me and said, "Do you want a ride?" So I accepted the ride. I had an EKG, I had all that stuff, and it turned out I had pneumonia. Just like, oh, that's just what it felt like, but I haven't had pneumonia in 50 years, so I didn't think of it as something I could get, but there it was. So I have an identity as a healthy person, takes care of myself, and doesn't need health insurance. I thought that my lifestyle protected me with a little help from heredity. Our bodies are impermanent. I too am subject to sickness, death, aging, all of that. And had it actually been a heart attack, I could have died. I was worried about becoming chronically ill with some of the other things, which of course I was looking up online until I got in that car. And Buddhism wouldn't have stopped any of that. And That makes me think of Bonnie Verbinkor, who I met for the first time when we were somewhere in our 30s. I visited her in Maine. I learned that she had some chronic sickness of some kind. And what she said about it was fascinating. She said, "You think, why should I have this? Why should this happen to me?" And then she said, "But really, why should I not have it? I can deal with it. I have practice. I have some stability. I'm as well prepared to deal with this as anybody." That's the kind of refuge that Buddhist practice gives us. Thoughts come and go. Emotions come and go. Physical things come and go, or we hope they'll go. And dealing with sickness and dealing with the after effects of the vaccine, I've recently been personally much more aware of how things come and go and how wonderful it is to just feel well, get up in the morning having slept well. And then, of course, there's going outside on a beautiful sunny day, which is an extra, extra wonderful thing to get attached to. And then the next day it's cold and rainy. So physical safety and even mental and emotional safety are not what Buddhist refuge is about. And yet, I mean, the physical thing is whatever the physical thing is, and we do our best as best we can to take care of our bodies. The emotional thing is something else. So if you throw a stone into a pond, there will be ripples. And the ripples go, and then they subside. And then it becomes still again. The ripples on a shallow pond are more they're bigger than the ripples on a deep pond. I learned this by living on the shore of a shallow lake, Lake Erie, which has very big waves. On the deeper lakes, the waves are different, less turbulent. And so that practice has more to do with creating the deep lake. And then the ripples are a little more shallow, and we're able to go forward even when we're torn with all kinds of difficulties and even emotional difficulties and losses. So I'm incapable of giving the talk that I wrote. I always have to recreate it. So give me a moment now. Okay. So when the Buddha left his palace and went out to see the real world, he saw death, old age, and sickness. And he saw a holy person, somebody who had left home to seek the truth. He decided to leave home and look for what was beyond all those things. The story is that they had protected him from those things because they wanted him to stay and become a king. This seems like poor judgment on their parts, but that's what the story says. And so he went. And he left all of his comfortable things, and he looked for freedom from suffering, and after a while, he found it. And he was hesitant to teach, but he finally gave in. The gods were after him. And so he said, "Okay, I'll talk about it. Maybe there will be some people, as they say, with little dust in their eyes." So In our tradition, there are four seals of the Buddhist teaching. It's like, if a teaching has these things, then it qualifies as a Buddhist teaching. And those things are suffering, no self, impermanence, and nirvana. When you accept that things are impermanent, when you accept that you are not permanent, you don't have an abiding, independent self, then you can become free from suffering and you can be in nirvana. In nirvana, that thing that confuses non-Buddhists, so I have to mention, it means blown out, but what it means is that the flame of suffering is blown out. It does not mean that you are blown out. There is no you. Or there is no you that can be blown out. You are born and born and reborn. It's just wonderful. It's like we are really alive. And when we try to think that we're permanent, that's how we become not alive. And then we're suffering. So we can, when we look around us, we can notice that people are suffering. We can notice that there's illusion. We certainly can see that somebody else has a confused idea of what's going on in the world. That term fake news, the stolen election, the fair election. It's like, no matter which person you are, you can see that somebody is deluded. And so in our personal lives, the fake news is that we are solid and permanent. And we have these minds that try to persuade us that we're permanent. They think that daily life won't work unless we're permanent. They think that not being permanent would be a disaster. And so, I want to talk about how it's not a disaster. So I learned the meal chant in a very old translation, and I totally fell in love with it. And some of you know it and some of you don't. So maybe I should say the whole thing and then focus in on the place that caught my attention. Innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Oh dear, I've forgotten it. Okay, so the part that I'm interested in is, as we desire the natural condition of mind to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. There is a natural condition of mind. That natural condition is not clinging. It's not trying to be permanent. It's not trying to save itself. It's not thinking about dying. The natural condition of mind is the thing that we are seeking and is the thing that I'm going to say, that's where refuge. I've been reading a couple of authors, Rebecca Solnit and Rutger Bregman, who both write about what humanity is. We've been subject for maybe 100 and maybe a couple thousand years to a PR campaign that says humans are evil, our natural condition is sin or greed or selfishness, to only care about ourselves, we're just economic creatures. That comes from the Enlightenment. And especially the last 100 years with modern advertising and Edward Bernays pushing Sigmund Freud's opinion, we have come to believe, we as a culture have come to believe this thing that human beings will do bad things if you leave them alone, and so you have to control them. We've come to think that civilization is our savior. And we also have an idea that we are gods. Humanism started that, you know, getting rid of the shackles of of a ridiculously powerful church, which promoted that humans were not okay. Then we had to be all powerful, and there was nobody above us. And being gods has gotten us to where we are now, which is not looking so good. I suspect that everybody here recognizes that this does not look so good, and it's getting worse. So I want to say the Buddhist position on the natural condition of mind is that we are free. We are created by other living things, and maybe non-living things, sentient beings. Who's included in sentient beings? You know, I include rocks and the rain and everything, but it's like, that's not so important. We are created by everything that's around us. We are dependent on everything that's around us. We are taken care of by everything that's around us. And, you know, I vote for living that way. So okay. So here's a poem by John O'Donohue. And I'm going to say it's about the support of all beings. It's called Blessings. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. Like hunter-gatherers who lived in the present, who did not store up food for the future because they knew they would be taken care of, we can live in the present. We have a lot of things around us, some in our minds and more in our culture, to prevent us from letting things support us. And we have this idea that enlightenment will help us. That's an idea that there's somewhere else to go. That gets entangled with the thought of refuge and with the word refuge. That thought comes from a culture that wasn't satisfied with the moment. It's Morris Berman distinguishes between immediate return and delayed return cultures. And he says the whole religious edifices, including shamanism, including transcendental and mystical states, they belong to the cultures that weren't satisfied in the moment, that were a little afraid. And they put things away and they developed civilization. So that thing that we call shikantaza, that thing that is so praised and said, this is enlightenment itself. That's a natural state. And it was a natural state of our ancestors a long time ago, or for some people more recently. So I'm proposing. Actually, I'm consistent with my teacher who says, well, you know, when we refuse to be enlightened until everyone else gets enlightenment with you, so you don't cross over the river to nirvana. Well, after a while, everyone on this side of the river in samsara is a bodhisattva. And guess what? Samsara is nirvana. There's no place to go. Oh, thank you, Sosan. Yes. Shikantaza, vivid sitting, sitting right down here in the middle of everything. Just being present. And I often say to people, it means being present and letting things create you and letting you create them. Not that you could stop this from happening, but you can allow yourself to notice it. So my proposal for refuge is just come back here. Come back to the natural state. It's safe here whether you live or die. This is home. Boy. So I have a whole pile of other things, but I think I want to let go of them and see if there are questions. And maybe the questions will bring us back to some of those other things, and maybe they won't. So I don't know, but you all know what your process is for questions.
I want to ask you about the thing you just said. Thank you, Shota, so much. When you said it's safe here, come back to the natural states. It's safe whether you live or die.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was writing. And what I actually wrote was that way of being present that we work and work and work for in our sitting practice. That's the natural state. And so my proposal is come on back to the natural state. Come back, come home. It's safe here. Whether you live or die, it's safe. So it's good that you challenged me on that. We live in a culture that doesn't understand death. I was 6 years old before I knew somebody who died. And some people make it a lot further than that. And some people, especially people in other cultures, it's like babies die. Babies die a lot. My mother had a miscarriage when I was in my teens. That was the closest I was to any of that. And so we come to think that what's normal is not, you know, to die when you're 80 or 100 or whatever. And so we think that safety is about the continued existence of our bodies. So I think what I need to talk about is what safety means. Actually, that's easy. So if I identify with this body, then I think it can be extinguished, and then I'm never safe. I could get hit by a car. I could slip and break my leg and not be able to reach anybody climbing the hill or something. And die of exposure. It's like there's no such thing as safety. But if we don't cling to our personal self, then the world goes on. If I'm identified with the trees and the oceans, with millions of people, not just my own family, then the world goes on. And particularly, it's like now the question of climate change brings up, well, what if all of this goes away? Well, how deeply am I identified with deciduous trees and certain kinds of animals and human beings? And then, of course, in the world of such violence, human beings are like, if I identify with the whole human species, this is like constant anguish. And I can't imagine saying not to be in pain because a child dies of starvation, or because a refugee drowns on a boat, or because a person is shot by the police, or worse. I can't say not have pain. But what I would say is, well, here's this whole big picture, this big conglomeration of living and non-living and sentient beings. I don't know if there's anybody that's not sentient, that, you know, that's some philosophical discussion. And pain is part of it. And the problem, of course, is that most of the pain is happening to other people, well, and to animals, you know, industrial agriculture and so forth. But overall, safety is not about individual survival. And that's what I meant. Thank you so much for asking. Another question?
So if you have a question, you can just unmute yourself, because Shoto might not be able to see your hand raised since there's multiple screens.
I can read something else. I could read any of many things. Okay, here we go. So originally this talk was supposed to start with Dogen's vow, which goes, we vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. Upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma, and that in doing so, the great earth and all living beings together will attain the Buddha way. And later on, and I'm thinking some of you have heard this, but rather than reading the whole thing, I'm going to say, He quotes the Chan master Lunya. Before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we. Enlightened people of today are exactly as those of old. Oh, somewhere else, he says himself, Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we. We in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. Revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. This is an incredibly radical statement. It means that that habit that we have of saying, okay, who's going to do it? Who will lead us? Who will solve this problem? Who will take care of the problem? There's nobody else. It's us. So we think that someone else is enlightened, or someone else is a Buddha, or someone else is a great leader, and we look for them to do it. We see, I recently did this. What was it? Oh, Georgia. Georgia and their stop people from voting law, and then arresting the black representative who knocked on the door just to get in and watch the signing. And I said about her arrest and her charge with a felony for knocking on the door, this is a good occasion for organizing. And I said this on Facebook, and somebody said to me, who's going to do the organizing? And I said, well, actually, I'm not in Georgia. It's not going to be me. I have several fires to put out in Minnesota that I'm, you know, not doing yet. So, but there are people, sometimes an ordinary person just picks up and takes a step and does something. So right now we have Tara Hauska leading the Stop Line 3 thing. And we're waiting to see. I know one of two people who went out to start a protest at Thacker Pass. It's about lithium mining. And when you confront lithium mining, you are confronting all of alternative energy. And so this is a huge thing, but these two guys went out there and did it. And now they're past 60 days and they're in the news, and there's been a walk by people from the local tribe. And it's like, oh, and Max and Will just went out there and pitched a tent. That's what they did. I did something once. I led a walk. But it's sort of, oh, what else? There's a guy in Africa. Actually, there's several stories. I read one in India. There was one in Africa. There's Wangari Maathai. Just start planting trees. And, you know, after 60 years of planting trees, there's a forest and the local village has water and things like this. We think of ourselves as powerless. We are conditioned to think of ourselves as powerless. And sometimes Buddhism plays into that by encouraging us to look at our mind and not get excited. But from that calm mind, and maybe we have this little tiny bit of a calm mind, from there, is there one step to take? Is there not laugh at a racist joke? One step. Is there plant one tree? One step. Is there give a little money to somebody? Or, you know, that first step is different for everybody. I mean, oh, Greta Thunberg is the outstanding example. And she's the famous one, but there are lots of other people like her. And being lots of other people is how things actually move. So, okay. And now we do have time for questions again. Or comments.
So, go ahead.
Did I speak over someone?
Zoom is you. Go ahead.
Terrible. We can't see each other. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to ask what you just said about one step, but also whole systems. So you see whole systems and you see how all of civilization, even the idea of civilization, makes humans gods. And then we start believing that greed and selfishness are normal. And then we have a system of control, blah, blah, blah. But then also you're saying one step. So how do you... can you say more about that one step, knowing that the system is so much bigger and like goes, you know, ancestrally and all that stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. So, of course, this has been the question of my life. And I was over 60 before I figured out what I was going to do with my life. Oh, okay. A story, an old story from, I think, the 1800s. There was this Japanese monk who wanted to go to Tibet, which was closed. You know, this is like before all the communist stuff and everything. So he wanted to go to Tibet. And I don't even remember why. He just wanted to. And so the first thing he did, instead of collecting money to pay for the trip, he collected karma. So he persuaded people to take vegetarian vows. And I don't know, somehow he got to Tibet and he went to learn. He spent a couple of years learning Tibetan. This is all preamble. Don't worry. And then he memorized the map of Tibet. So no matter where he was, with people questioned his accent, he could say he was someplace far away so he wouldn't get caught, because getting caught could mean imprisonment, torture, and death. Anyway, so he's out there on foot on these winding mountain paths, and sometimes he would come to a fork in the road and he had no idea which way to go. He would sit zazen until it became clear. And then he would, whichever path he was moved to take, he would take that. And so people nowadays, or some people, understand intuition, but to make your intuition work, sometimes you need to slow down for a long time. And so my time of not knowing which way I was going to go, a couple decades of it involved a fair amount of zazen and, you know, studying the teachings and all that stuff that we do. So that's one answer is, well, you know, calm down enough so you can see which way. And the other answer is, well, what path are you on and what confronts you? What comes up in front of your face? And then find the response to that thing that comes up in front of you. And people, Satish Kumar wrote a book titled No Destination. And it's the story of his life from a certain point, from when he left home to become a Jain monk until, I don't know, a few decades later. And he's still, you know, teaching and writing and so forth. But that no destination is sort of like what he describes as, well, he did sometimes take a direction, like he decided to walk to England. And his teacher said, don't take any money. So he had to completely live on the generosity of people who he encountered, including somebody had to pay for him to get on the boat across to England. But it's one step at a time. And some people take a chunk of time, you know, like a day every week or a week of retreat or a month of something in which that's the way you live. You pay attention to what's calling to you, what's asking to be done. So when I work with the land here, I do that. I certainly have lots of ideas about what should be done. But when I actually go out with my and put my hands in the dirt, or I might have saws and clippers and things like that, I try to be in the state of the mind that says, okay, what do you need me to do? What is called for here? What does the whole need? Not do what my civilized intentions call for, but what does the place call for? And I try to listen to that. I think that rest periods or timeout periods are really important, and community is important. And so the announcement of the practice period is pretty important. And I think at Clouds you have a lot of support for asking those questions. What is my step? What will I do? And then I suddenly thought, oh, maybe this is my chance to tell you we are having a work study, a work practice period out here. It's a chance, if you're tired of sitting online, it's a chance for a fairly few people to get, thank you, there we go, to be outdoors and to be with other people and to be sitting. And I have somebody right now, here right now, who came from line three and is quarantining in a tent, and her friends are taking her food and stuff like that. So we have the ability even to do a quarantine here if that should be necessary. So it's sort of an invitation to be out and be in a practice setting. And of course, help me with a bunch of stuff I need done. So that was an ad. Sosan posted the contact, the information there. Is that any? You moved on my screen. And do you have more of a question there? Okay. Was it Brent, the other person? I know somebody had a question. It's also okay.
I guess it was going through my mind. You were talking about your whole conversation, but acknowledging that everything supports us, but in a practical sense, what helps you in practical everyday life? What comes to my mind is gratitude, maybe. I mean, that's sort of what you said. So it kind of answered the question myself, but maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit.
I might ask you to. Gratitude is a wonderful thing. And I remember somebody said, oh no, they were saying patience is the only step. Patience is good too. But to find gratitude and to meet whatever comes with gratitude is, I have not yet become grateful for that emergency room event. and it would help me if I did. I did finally notice that it had something to do with karma. And of course, the thing about karma, if something bad happens, you can go, oh, good, I burned off that little bit of karma. Karma meaning cause and effect. And so some past negative actions leave a residue. And that residue creates something that shows up in our present life. So that probably wasn't what you're thinking. Why don't you add something to that?
I don't know what to add.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Events for the past year have affected us all, and mm-hmm. it's been really difficult, accepting it as it is. But I guess my question is, what helps you get up in the morning, and what keeps mm-hmm. you going? Maybe that's probably what we're all having.
Yeah. I have been in such a privileged position this past year that I hardly dare to speak to people who've been suffering. So I'm a therapist. Now I don't have to go to the office. I just have to deal with seeing people on the screen. I was going to have a beginner's retreat one weekend. And so instead I had an online class, and now I have an online sitting group or an online study group. It's like the pandemic gave me a sangha to work with. So they're things that I don't like, but they're nothing even close. I don't like wearing a mask, but it's not a big deal. So I'm grateful to the pandemic. I'm also grateful for the awareness change even as the country has gotten extremely polarized, and other countries too are doing pretty scary things, I'm in touch with, I'm seeing the response, and it's a very full of life kind of response, and more people saying, you know, no, we're going to be like this. We're not going to be like that. And choosing a more humane and more connected way to live. And I think that I certainly would never have chosen that person as president, but I think there's been some, it's been kind of a wake-up call. And I don't know what's going to happen next. And I have personal fear about it. But when I think about the big picture, I go, oh, look. And, you know, and finally some court battles are being won on environmental things. And white people are rising up, looking for where they can show solidarity to people of color, taking leadership. This is, we're in a different world, and it has some things that are really, really hard. And I'm not the person who's getting hurt by them. I may, you know, I could marry another woman now if I wanted to. There was a time in my life when I had to pretend that I wasn't who I was. And now it's like, I'm not weird for that. I'm normal. So I personally have so much to be grateful for. And I look and it's like, there are a lot of other people who are paying the price. I could be grateful to them, but mostly they didn't choose it. So that's kind of hard. So, okay. Thank you all for the questions.